Hi, good evening. This is part two of a shir on Eicha, or Yirmiyahu's Lamentations. But don't worry, if you weren't here for the first shir, if you weren't here for the first lesson, there's plenty of new material here, and we're going to approach it from a slightly different angle. Just to do a little bit of a recap, we're focusing really on the first two chapters and the last two chapters, leaving out the middle chapter. I had hoped when I first set up the shir with Rabbi Kelman to focus on the third chapter, which is a personal lament from an unknown person, and focus just on that. But we went a little more in depth, and there's still a lot of ground to cover, so hopefully we'll have a time to peek at chapter three. But mostly we're going to stay focused on the first two chapters and the last two chapters. That being said, if everybody has an Eicha or a Tanakh, I have sources here, but we found last week that when I flipped to the sources page, it became a little bit confusing. I'll do that a little bit, but if you have a Tanakh, that's probably for the best. And what I'd like to do now is I'd like to propose my thesis that will really guide the shir altogether. If you have questions in the middle, I know it's always hard to ask questions a little hard to ask questions in this format. If you have audio, feel free to interrupt, and I'll try to respond as best I can. Otherwise, you can simply put things in the message box, and I'll try to keep an eye on that so as not to miss any questions. And here's the thesis. When we generally look at a book of Tanakh, like Eicha, where there appears to be no narrative, so we sort of look at it as kind of one big glom, as if, you know, it's a famous question that people always ask when they're learning Yeshayahu or the other books of prophets, which is, why does Yeshayahu have to repeat himself over and over and over? Yeah, I get it, we're bad. You know, I don't need another 45 chapters where Yeshayahu practices his poetry to explain to us how bad we are in 50 or 65 different ways. And the truth is, while there are some times where the prophet tries to approach the same problem from a different poetic standpoint, and by using a different force of poetry, he may extract meaning that doesn't exist the first time. Very often what you have is you have a progression. We really obviously don't have time to do Sefer Yeshayahu, but I could demonstrate in Yeshayahu that in one case there's a prophecy around chapter 28 or 29, where it's 3 years from the march of Ashur against Israel, from the near destruction of Israel, the siege of Jerusalem, and then 4 chapters later, there's only 1 year left to go, and the picture has changed. What's going on in Israel has changed, and therefore Yeshayahu needs to express it in a different way. So, what does that have to do with Sefer Eicha? What I would argue, and it's an argument that can be debated, and I'll try to demonstrate it as best as I can, is that there's actually a process going on in Eicha where we're not looking at one event where Yeshayahu is sort of, Yirmiyahu is post-destruction of the temple, and he's just writing everything, dumping everything out in 5 chapters. But actually what's going on here is each one of the chapters, 1, 2, and 4 and 5, leaving aside the middle chapter right now, describes a different phase of the destruction of Jerusalem, which of course is bad news, but then again, an Eicha Shir is not supposed to be a particularly happy kind of event. But essentially, Israel goes through 4 stages of destruction, or phases of destruction. And each destruction is described quite clearly. Now, of course, with biblical poetry, we tend not to, you know, the words are so difficult, and we say, oh, it's poetry, so we tend not to focus on the nuances between the texts. But I think what I'll try to demonstrate is that there really are definitive phases in the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of Jerusalem and the Jews in Jerusalem and in Eretz Yehuda, and that is described chapter by chapter, first chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 4, and chapter 5. Now, in order to do that, I'm going to switch and try to show something on my screen, which hopefully you'll see on your computer. If you happen to have an Internet Explorer open, you can go to my website, ericlevy.com, and there's a timeline of Israel. But I'll give you a snapshot of the timeline of Israel and try to describe what is happening during the process, what is politically and militarily happening during the last 20 to 25 years of Israel's existence, essentially from 609, which is the death of the famous Yoshiyahu, and the great King Yoshiyahu, until the exile in 587, 586. So I'm going to switch out now to that screen, and bear with me. I can hear your audio, so if you have something to say or if it's not coming in, please feel free. I won't see the chat windows for a minute, but I'll just put this up for a minute. So let me switch to the application. Right. And I'm going to go to Microsoft PowerPoint. And I'll try to zoom in here on the relevant material. What you may be seeing here is a timeline. And let me see if I could position this on the screen in a way that makes sense, although it may be a little bit challenging. Okay. On the left-hand side of the timeline, right around, you'll notice that there's a top section of the timeline where you see purple and green stripes, and those are the kings that are in power in the ancient Near East, not including Israel. So, of course, you'll see Nebuchadnezzar, which is the famous Nebuchadnezzar, and the purple actually is what's going on in Egypt at the time. On the bottom of the, right below, there's like a light blue line. You'll see it says Josiah, which is Yoshiyahu, killed by Paro Necho. And essentially, you have sort of a classic war between the two superpowers at the time. You have Mesopotamia, which used to be really run by Ashur, versus, and that's to Israel's north, northeast. And then you have Egypt, which is sort of the other superpower. And both of those super countries are vying for the very valuable real estate of the Mediterranean coast, which is where we are both blessed and sometimes cursed, not cursed really, but certainly there's a lot of contention around such a valuable piece of real estate. Yoshiyahu was killed by Necho when Necho, who was the king of Egypt, was going to protect Ashur. Because what's happening is Ashur was the old bad guy on the market. But at least Ashur had some civilization, some sense that you don't come in and completely wipe out everything that you see. They did a lot of deportations. They were certainly a vicious country. But Mitzrayim was much more afraid of the newcomer on the block, which is Babel or Babylonia. So Necho tries to go and defend Ashur against Babel, which is in southern Mesopotamia. Yoshiyahu gets in his way, and Necho essentially kills him in battle. Necho then, Yoshiyahu is then replaced by his son named Yehoahaz ben Yoshiyahu, but then Yehoahaz is deposed by Necho because Yehoahaz is pro-Mesopotamian. And Paro Necho, who's Egyptian, wants somebody who takes his side of view. And therefore he establishes another of Yoshiyahu's children, not the oldest, named Yehoiakim. Yehoiakim. Yehoiakim rules for 11 years, but during that time, things go bad. That is, Yehoiakim was a puppet for Paro. But Paro and Egypt are getting weaker and weaker, and Nebuchadnezzar is getting stronger and stronger, until if you take a look at the top, you'll see Paro Necho's is defeated by Nebuchadnezzar, and during that defeat of Egypt, he takes Yehoiakim and he deposes him. He gets rid of him. He establishes, or Yehoiakim comes into power, and Yehoiakim, who is the son, rules only for 6 months until he himself is essentially pulled into chains and moved into exile into Babel. A lot of people are exiled at this time. Something like 2,000 or 3,000 people from Jerusalem are exiled. But just because people are exiled doesn't mean that Jerusalem is finished. And Nebuchadnezzar establishes another king by the name of Tzidkiyahu. You'll see him soon at the bottom of the page. Tzidkiyahu rules for 11 years at the permission of Nebuchadnezzar. In the 11th year, he decides to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar comes and he completely destroys Jerusalem and takes away Tzidkiyahu, pokes his eyes out, kills his children. And that's really the end of Tzidkiyahu. So there are two kings that are deposed by Nebuchadnezzar, the first being Yehoiakim, the son of Yehoiakim, the son of Yoshiyahu, and another being Yoshiyahu's nephew, Tzidkiyahu, But afterwards, you'll notice that even after the temple is destroyed, there's still room for more Judeans to be exiled, which means it's not like, and I'm going to switch back so we could all see each other now. Let me switch back to the application. Okay. Whenever you look at these things, we tend to look at the exile, like with a capital E, as if everything is happening at once. But really, in history, in all of history, including Jewish history at the end of the First Temple, things are going on in phases. There's phases. So essentially what we have is Nebuchadnezzar comes to power but is not ready to defeat Paro. Then Nebuchadnezzar defeats Paro, exiles the Judean king Jehoiachin. He sets up his own puppet for 11 years, and then when that puppet, Zedekiahu, rebels against Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar comes back to Israel, exiling, pretty much destroying the temple, and exiling, really taking the country of Yehuda and finishing it off completely. And those are the phases that take place historically during the destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the land of Yehuda. And what I'll try to show now by going into Megillat Eicha is that those words are really reflected in the text as well. By the way, just for those who are curious, if you take a look at Sefer Yirmiyahu, chapter 52, you'll see that in verse 28, 29, and 30, and 31, those phases of destruction or exile are really categorized in like one after the other. And I'll read them right now. Zeha am asher hegla nebuchad retzar bishnat sheva, that's sheva lenebuchadnezzar, which was when he overthrew Egypt, and Egypt no longer became a player. He exiled shloshet alafim ve'esrimu shlosha, that's 3,023. The next pasuk in Yirmiyahu, chapter 52, verse 29, reads, Bishnat Shmona Esrei Lenebuchadnezzar, which means 11 years later, which is at the time that Zedekiah rebels against him, Nebuchadnezzar comes back to town and really finishes off Jerusalem. It says, Miyushlayim Nefesh Shmona Meot Shloshim Ushnayim, 832. Now, you notice that's not a lot of people, which means even before, while the temple was still standing during that 11-year process, Jerusalem and Israel were not really populated as they were before Jehoiachin was sent into exile. Then in verse number 30, Pasuk Lamed, in that same chapter, it says, B'shnat shlosh ve'esrim Nebuchadnezzar, it is 23rd year, Hagla Nebuzad Radan, which is his Rava Tabachim, Nebuchadnezzar didn't bother him coming to town, he sent his vicious general, Nefesh Shvamiot Arba'im Chamesh, Kol Nefesh Arba'at Alafim Shesh Meot, and it sums out all of the exiles. Vahi B'shloshim V'sheva Shanan, the 37th year, L'galut Yehoyachin, Melech Yudah, B'shnevatar Chodesh, B'esrim Chamishal Chodesh, Nasa Avil Merodach, Melech Bavel, B'shnat Malchuto, at Rosh Yehoyachin, Melech Yudah V'yetzei Ototomi Beit HaKalu. Now this is kind of cool, because if you remember, 11 years before the destruction of the temple, that was when Yehoyachin, the son of Yoshiah, was exiled by Nebuchadnezzar. But he was kept in jail and considered to be sort of the true, quote-unquote, the true king, with Zedekiahu, who was only a nephew of Yoshiahu, being sort of a placeholder. When after Nebuchadnezzar dies, Evil Merodach, who is his son, sort of appreciates Yehoyachin. He doesn't send him back to Israel, but he takes him out of jail, he gives him food, and we have this documentation not only in Yirmiyahu, but in Babylonian chronicles as well, and their history matches our history. So as you can see, things are really going in phases. Now, with that kind of long setup, let's actually go to the text. Are there any questions up to this point? Would anybody like to jump in? First of all, Shalom, am I coming in clearly? Am I speaking too fast? Is everything going okay so far, technically?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay, very good. You were able to see the graphics? Did the graphics come in okay with the exile in phases?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, let's actually get to the meat and potatoes, and I am going to switch over to my sources just to give you a sense of how I want to teach it, but afterwards I'm going to rely on a lot of people, you know, kind of rely on you to be looking inside Tanakh, but don't worry, I will read all the psukim that I have, and I will translate them as well. But I'm going to switch over now to my PowerPoint and show you the approach that I am taking to the rest of the text to show you that Yirmiyahu himself wrote Eicha. I don't want to say he wrote it in phases, because the chances are he wrote it all at once after the end of the final Exile, which is after Gedalia is, you know, so Gedalia after Gedalia is exiled. However, what he is doing is channeling four different time periods and four different emotions. So if you take a look, the first thing that he's, what we'll do is, we'll do this a little bit like, I forget what the name of that medical operation is when they shoot dye into veins, and then you can see the dye going through the veins and therefore track the way the veins and the arteries are working. Does anybody know what that's called? Any doctors out there? Okay. Well, in any event, what you see in front of you is famine. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take various issues that Yirmiyahu deals with and show you that there's a stage of development for each of those issues. So I'm going to do famine, I'm going to do Jerusalem itself, and I'm going to do the leadership of what happens to the leadership of Israel. And with that, I'll switch back now so I can see you all. Just a second. Okay. And here we are back. So what I'll do is I'll... I just got a question saying, can we more focus more on the contents of this history, meaning the psychology and philosophy of this period? Oh, well, that's a very big subject to answer, Richard, who posted on. I will try to get into the psychology. The philosophy of the period really deals with the issue of how did the Jews feel about themselves? Did they consider themselves sinners? What kind of sins did they perform? And the truth is, Sefer Echa is a little bit light on that. Yirmiyahu is more describing what he sees, more than really trying to put the blame. He does a little bit. So I will, I will try to move away just from a specific history and get into the actual text itself now. Let's take a look at Perek Aleph. Let's take a look at Perek Aleph and actually read the Psukim. And, of course, a lot of this is easy to follow because keep in mind that Sefer Echa is written alphabetically. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to verse Chaf. Let me see if I'm right. No, not verse Chaf. Verse Yud. Just a second. I'm looking for the verse in Echa. In chapter 1, there's a pasuk that says, Kol aman enachim mevakshim lachem. It's in pasuk Yud Aleph. And as I mentioned last time, Yirmiyahu goes alphabetically for the first two chapters and for the fourth chapter, which is going to interest us. So let's take a look at the pasuk. And this pasuk describes the situation of famine with the in Yerushalayim itself. And it's and he says, Kol amah ne'nachim mevakshim lechem. All of her citizens are sighing. They're searching for food. Natnu machama dehem ba'ochel lahashiv nafesh. They are giving away all of their treasured items. And that word machama dehem we're going to come back to quite a few times. But they're giving away kol machama dehem. They're giving away, like they're selling off, you know, what's gold worth? What's silver worth when you can't eat? So people start trading away their valuables simply for food. So he says, kol v'natnu machama dehem ba'ochel v'ashiv nafesh, in order to bring themselves back because they're starving. Re'e Adonai v'habita ki ayiti zalela. Look how poor I was. God, look at me. You see how poor I was. And that's, by and large, the whole description of famine in or of the starvation process that's going on in Echa Perek Aleph. Now what I would suggest we do is please skip ahead to Echa Perek Bet, and we'll find a different description. In Pasuk, I have to find it, the Pasuk reads like this. Kalu b'dma'ot enai, chamar maru me'ai. I have no tears left in my eyes. It is when people are sort of short on liquids and they are. This is in pasuk yud aleph. They're dehydrated or they're describing a situation perhaps psychologically where they've just cried so much. There's really very little left to cry. But we'll see how they're describing the situation of food on the ground. In Pasuk Yud Aleph, Kalu b'dma'ot enai chamar maru me'ai. My innards, my guts are the word chamar maru is a difficult word. It could be turning into chomer. Chamarim are like piles, which is my stomach is getting all knotted up. Nishpach la'aretz kvedi, my liver is falling out to the ground, al shever batemi, be'ateif olel v'yoneg v'chovot kiriya. And now we've moved on to something that we did not see in chapter one. What we're looking at is actual starvation. In chapter two, we're looking at actual starvation. In chapter one, the children weren't in the street. People are just going around, and they find out that their gold and silver is really not worth much anymore because of the situation on the ground. So they're starting to trade all the things that they, you know, things are really bad, that pretty piece of silver up on your bookshelf doesn't look so good, so you trade it away for food. But people are not at the starvation point. In Perek Bet, where it says, Olel v'yoneik b'rchovot kiriya, where the children, Olel is used in two different meanings in Sefer Eicha. One is to mean plot, Olelayach, and the other one means children, and they play against each other. The children in the street, and they are passing out. Be'ateif, in modern Hebrew, be'ateif means to cloak oneself. It's also used in biblical Hebrew, but here it really means kind of fainting, and you can imagine a picture of people wandering the streets with their hands on their heads and passing out because of the lack of the food. And what happens? They say to their mothers in the next pasuk, Le'imotam yomeru, aye dagan v'ayin, where is the bread? Where is the wine? V'hitatzvam kechalal b'chovot ir. Now notice, they're not dead. They're not dying of starvation. V'hitatzvam kechalal b'chovot ir. But they're passing out and they look like dead bodies in the streets. V'hishtapech nafsham o'cheshimotam. They're throwing themselves at their mothers, the children. Where's food? Where's food? And you can really imagine this situation. Unfortunately, and I guess that some of what I should really be doing is channeling some of the pain, although it's very difficult to do so. But you can imagine the kids, I mean, the adults know what's going on. They know they're in a situation of starvation, of greater starvation. But what do children know? The children turn to their parents, and they know what they know, and they know that their mothers will give them food. And yet there's no food to be gone. There's no answer to the children as they come to their mothers. Then in the next pasuk, it says, Kumi, not in the next pasuk, in the Kuf pasuk, which is down on verse, we're in chapter 2, verse 19, Kumi Roni Balaila L'Rosh Hashmirot. And this is where the author, and we discussed this last time, where the author is actually speaking to Jerusalem herself, saying, don't just cry at night, cry all the time. Don't be quiet, because now is the time for you to cry out. Shifchi Kamayim Libech Nochach Pnei Adonai, call out directly in front of God. See Eliyah Kapayim, raise your arms up to him. And that's not really a phrase that's not really a Kohen imagery, but that's the imagery of people just praying with their arms lifted up. Al Nefesh Ol Eliyah Atufim Barav Barosh Kol Chotzot. If you go to every chutzah, every broad space, and every place, people are gathering in the Warsaw ghetto, and simply at some point finding, you know, first trading everything they have for a little piece of bread, and finally everything simply runs out. Shalom, am I coming in? Is my sound okay? Oh, okay, good. Finally, the last pasuk is the Resh pasuk. Again, it's all alphabetic. And if we take a look at Pasuk Chaf, which is the Reish Pasuk, it's, again, we have this, look at me, God. Re'e Adonai v'habita l'mi olalta ko. Now, do you see the play on words there? In the previous Pasuk, olalayach meant your children, your desperate, starving children. But here, we sort of turn to God and complain. There's a complaint here. Not a complaint in the whiny sense of the word, but like a legal complaint. Look at God, l'mi olalta ko. Who did you plot against? But there's a play of words. It's the children who you're plotting against. In tochalna nashim piryam olei tipuchim im yehareg mikdash Adonai kohen v'navi. And those two ims are very, very important. I'll read the pasuk again. Im tochalna nashim piryam olei tipuchim means lest, or can it be that, which means that we're not up to this point yet. The word im is used this way quite often in Sefer Yeshayahu. The connection to this Sefer Eicha really borrows from Yeshayahu's work, but that's really beyond the scope of the shir. But what he's saying is not that the women are eating, nashim tochalna piryam, they're eating their children, olalei tipuchim, the children of their tipuchim probably comes to the word tefach, their small ones, their little ones. A tefach is like a fist, or perhaps the children that they hold in their arms. Im yeharei b'mikdash Adonai kohen v'navi. It doesn't mean that Kohanim and Nevi'im are now dying in the Beit HaMikdash. It means lest they, or is it possible, that is, look at me, God, now. Yirmiyahu is talking to Jerusalem before Jerusalem is destroyed, and people are starving in the streets. And he's saying, Jerusalem, you have to lift up your voices. Now, as we saw last week, of course, Jerusalem is a personification of the Israel people herself who embody her. And we'll get to that a little bit more later. But Yirmiyahu is saying, don't be quiet for this kind of thing. Call out in the middle of the night. Al tidat milach, al tiyeh pugat lach. Don't be quiet. It's not possible that we could get to the phase where children are eating, where children are being eaten by their mothers because of starvation. Unfortunately, in chapter 4, and we're skipping chapter 3, because chapter 3 is really kind of a separate book in and of itself, but in chapter 4 we'll see that exactly what Yirmiyahu was hoping, or that Yerushalayim was hoping would not happen, is exactly what took place. So I would ask you now to switch to chapter 4 of Yirmiyahu, and we'll take a look at the Dalad Pasuk, which is the fourth Pasuk in Yirmiyahu. I'm going to just take a breather and give a chance to people to open up to Eicha Perek Dalet, chapter 4 of Lamentations. And here things become really bad. The truth is, I kind of skipped Pasuk, the Gimel Pasuk, and I'd like to go back to it right now. It's a difficult Pasuk. I'll try to translate it as best as I can, or how I see the Pasuk, because it feeds into Pasuk Dalet. Gimel says, Gam Tanim. Tanim are some kind of jackals or foxes that inhabit desolate places. Gam Tanim. It's written, by the way, as Tanim, which are crocodiles or snakes or some type of lizard, but the Kri is Tanim, which is much more likely. So, as we'll see, because they're going to be nursing, which reptiles don't do. So, Gam Tanim Chaltsu Shad. They uncover their chests. Heiniku Gurehem, which is even these Tanim, which are known to be vicious attacking animals, the mothers are merciful to at least to their own children. Heiniku Gurehem, they take their cubs and they give them milk, they nurse them. However, Bat Amil Achzar Kayainim Bamidbar, but my nation, in contrast, is become completely vicious like Yainim Bamidbar. Which is some kind of animal, some kind of bird, which is apparently has no mercy on its child whatsoever. And now we get to the actual situation. The famine has now spread. Davak l'shon yonef el chiko batzama. The tongue of the nursing child, the infant, is stuck to the inside of its mouth, to its chek, the roof of its mouth. Batzama and starvation. The babies, the children, are asking for lechem, pores ein lahem. There's not even a single piece of bread. So we've gotten to the point where in the first chapter, people, there was food around, but people were, you know, trading it in for expensive items. In the second chapter, there was so little food that people were passing out, the mothers didn't know what to do. Here in the third one, there's such a level of starvation that there's not a single slice of bread to be had for anybody. Moving on to the Hey Pasuk, which is the fifth Pasuk. Ha'ochlim l'ma'adanim nashamu b'chutzot. And here we get to a new phase, really, which we didn't have before. What that means is those who usually eat sweets, ma'adanim are like fancy or wealthy, food of the wealthy. Nashamu b'chutzot, which means normally what happens in a situation of famine is the poor go first because they don't have money for food. But the rich had plenty of stuff to trade for the food and plenty of stock and storage where they could really manage to get food. But at some point, even for the rich, you get to the point where there's nothing left for them either. And that's what this pasuk means. Ha'ochlim l'ma'adanim nashamu b'chutzot ha'emunim alei tola chibku ashbatot. And here there's a double play in words. The word tola is worms, but it's referring to silk. Ha'emudim, those who rely alei tola on silk, those who walk around in their silk cloaks, the riches, the intelligentsia, the powerful, chibku ashbatot, even they are poking through the garbage. So at this point in the parak, we've really moved way beyond what we had in parak bet to the point of almost absolute starvation, where even the rich are desperate for food. Now, if we take a look in the next two psukim, this starvation, which really is a major focus of this chapter, is so shocking to Yirmiyahu that he has to describe what he sees. So if we skip, actually, you know what, it pays to read Pasuk Vav also. That doesn't describe the starvation, but there's an interesting point to be made about verse 6. By the way, if somebody, is it okay that we're reading the text like this? Is everybody able to follow along? Okay, so I have a little bit of yes, a little bit of no. So what I'll try to do, on the case of the no, am I talking too fast? Biter. Okay. Okay, and I'll try to take it a little step by step, a little bit slower, but still cover the material. If we read Pasuk Vav is a very important idea of Judaism, of biblical Judaism and philosophical Judaism as well. And I don't want to take a tangent because we could spend a lot of time on that. But in Judaism, the words for sin and punishment are the same, or can be the same. That is, avon could be both the sin of somebody as well as the punishment, which gets into the issue of mida keneged mida, and the fact that maybe there's no such thing as punishment, but it's more action and consequence. If you do a good deed, you get rewarded, not as a reward, but as a consequence. And if you do something bad or you do something terrible, then it's not so much that you get punished, but the consequence is that you have to make up for what it is that you did. It's reflected that way in the Hebrew language because avon means both sin as well as punishment. The most famous case of that is in Bereshit, where Cain, after killing his brother and being told that he's now going to be exiled, says to God, Gadol avoni means so. My avon is too great to bear or too great to forgive. So, and the Mefarshim are all trying to work out. Does he mean that my punishment that God's given me is too great and it's not fair, it's not justified based on my crime? Or is it gadol avonim, and so I realize that I've sinned so badly that I know that you won't forgive me, but have mercy on me anyway. And this ambiguity is here also, but I think here we're really talking about punishment, not sin. Vayigdal in Pasuk Vav, Vayigdal avon bat ani mechatat sedom. So one way to translate this, and maybe the best way is to translate it both ways, the sin of my nation is greater than the sin, the chatat of Sodom. But I think that really we're talking about the punishment. And Yirmiyahu says this is not fair. Vayidal avon bat ami, the punishment of my nation is worse than the punishment of Sodom. Hafchu kmo rago v'lo chalu bayadayim, because at least they were taken out right away. V'lo chalu bayadayim, they didn't have a chance to pray. Chalu bayadayim, actually I'll leave alone the translation for that right now. But there's a sense here of, wow, at least they got, you know, a meteor fell on their heads right away. Better that, to go in an instant, than to be one of the wounded suffering that dies slowly of starvation. There's another pasuk like that that we're going to get to later, although it's not clear that it's saying the same thing. And now, that is, the starvation is so shocking, I mean, I was essentially saying this is worse than what happened to Sodom. And now let's get to the actual starvation, the famine, pasuk Zion. Zaku nizira mishaleg. Now, some translators translate the word zako as at some time they were righteous, from the word zochah. However, what it probably means here is they became white. Zaku nizireha mishaleg. Your nizirim, which really means your leadership. We know that it means leadership from Yosef. The bracha of Yosef says, tie nazir la'achecha. You will be a leader for your brothers. So zakun nizira mishali means they turned white, which is they became pasty with the lack of food, with the starvation. Sachu mechalav, they became as clear as milk. That is, they literally a deathly, deathly pale. On the other hand, admu etzem mipninim, their bones, which gives one the impression. Now Rashi and other mepharshim try to explain that etzem doesn't really mean bones; it means their appearance. But we may actually be talking about bones, because when the starvation becomes so bad, you have a skin rot, and the bones start to show through, and what's happening is that those part of the body are turning red, not a good red, but a bruised brown red, and the pneum obviously are dark, they're obviously, pneum are, what's the word, pearls. And those pearls, obviously not the white type of pearls, but the darker pearls. Sapir gizratam, their view, the way they look, is like sapphire. And not in a, oh, thank you, rubies. Thank you very much. And, yes, certainly that color, a red like that. Pnimim in modern Hebrew, I know Susan Hyland Park says that Pnimim are rubies. This may very well be true. I believe there is another word for rubies in Tanakh, which we're going to take a look at a little bit later. But either way, it's certainly a dark red stone, so it may well, very well be rubies. Sapir Gizratan, that is, normally we talk about these, we'll see, there's that, Yirmiyahu is being horribly and brutally ironic. People are normally supposed to be described as jewels in a positive way, which, God willing, we'll get to in a little bit. But here, their bodies are turning the color of the jewels, which is anything but a positive sense, but is the worst possible sense. And it continues in the next pasuk, Chashach Mishchor Taram, their view, it becomes blackened, which means, again, we're at the next stage where the skin starts to rot. Lo Nikru B'chutzot, when people see each other in the streets, in the open places, they're not even recognizable. Tzafad oram al atzmam, their skin becomes like hardened. The word tzipud now means like roasted on their bodies. Yavesh hayaka eitz, it dried up and became like wood. And then the next pasuk is just amazing. That was the pasuk that I referred to. The question of, it seems to be a question of what's better, to go fast or to go slowly. So the pasuk starts, Tovim hayu chalalei cherev mechalalei ra'av. It's better for those who died by the sword than those died by starvation. But what's interesting here, I mentioned it in last year, but it's such a good interpretation by Rav Yosef Kara. That's not Rav Yosef Kairo of the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yosef Kairo was a student of Rashi. He was a great Rav by himself, but like most people, he left his own yeshiva to go study at Rashi's feet. And he says that if you look at the next pasuk, the next part of the pasuk, Shehem Yazuvu Medukarim, they are dripping or drooling as if stabbed, or more than those that are stabbed, mitznuvot sadai. And Rav Yosef Kara says like this, that when you're starving, you're desperate, and you're essentially your body is rotting away, even if you find a piece of food, when you eat it, it could literally kill you. And this is what happened, of course, there's stories like this in the Holocaust, where I mentioned this last week, but I think it bears repeating, where people, you know, when the Allies came and they freed the people from the concentration camps, they gave them their rations, and unfortunately, there were people, the Jews, who actually managed to survive Auschwitz, and when they ate this food, they weren't able to bear the food and died of food poisoning, really, of destroying themselves with the food. And that's the level of the starvation that we have. So what you could see is step by step by step, we have an ever-increasing amount of disease and despair. And then finally, let's take a look at Pasuk Yud. Yidei Nashim Rachmaniot Bishlu Yaldeihem. The merciful women. And the word Rachmaniot is a very interesting word. It means merciful, but it comes from the word Rechem, which is a womb. That is, before it became a verb, it was a noun in ancient Semitic languages. Why? Because just the way a woman feels about the product of her womb, her children, that feeling got turned into the word Rachmaniot. Actually, Rachman and Rachamim, by the way, in Hebrew is mercy from the word Rechem, but what's interesting is in Aramaic it means love. Ahava is translated by Unculus as Racham. But they're cooking their children. Hayu levarot mamo. They were food. They were food for themselves, b'shever batami, and that's really where Pasuk Perek Daled ends as far as the starvation goes. We've come to the point where people lose their humanity. That is, in chapter 1, things were bad, there wasn't a lot of food, so people, you know, had a bad situation. In chapter 2, the children, really, we've run out completely of food, even the rich are having a hard time finding food, and the children turn to the parents and saying, well, there's no food. In Perek Daled, we sort of have two stages, where the food is gone for everybody. The rich are looking in the garbages and finding nothing. And slowly but surely, people are dying of famine to the point where b'shever batami, where they lose their very humanity, and the mothers that had mercy for the children, well, it's every person for himself. Again, this gets into issues of things I don't know about. I know Tanakh. I don't know, I'm not an expert in Jewish history. We know that there was cannibalism among the Russian prisoners in the Holocaust. We just assume that no Jew ever resorted to cannibalism, dying of starvation in the Holocaust. But on the other hand, we do know and we could hope it's true, although I'm probably not convinced that among all the millions who died that nobody lost their humanity. And who could blame them? Not blame them, but who could really judge them except for God? Because when you have your humanity taken away, your actions become, you know, they're almost robotic. And we certainly know of Jews who sold out other Jews. There were kapos, and who did what they needed to do for self-preservation. And at some point, the self-preservation becomes so horrible that mothers are willing to do in their own families. And again, this theme of mothers versus children and how the children are suffering is what Yir Miyahu is focusing on, because Yir Miyahu thinks it's not fair. Finally, in Perek Tei, we get to a very strange stage, which would seemingly go against everything I've said up to this point. If you take a look at Perek Hei, it's one of the earlier verses. Let me find it. Verse Dalet. Now here we're no longer alphabetical. There are 22 psukim matching the 22 letters in the alphabet, but Yir Miyahu does not keep to the acrostic, to the Aleph Bet Gimel, for reasons which we can only speculate. But as I said last week, I think it's because since all civilization has died away, the Shever Batami, that Yir Miyahu is presenting that the very structure of human civilization, the alphabet, is no longer captured. That even though there are 22 psukim, the alphabet is lost. So in Pasuk Dalet it says, Meimenu Bekesef Shatinu, our water we drank with silver, that is, we traded our silver for water. Atseinu b'mechir yavo, and we had to buy wood, that is, to cook things or to heat up things, with a price. Al tzavareinu, let's continue on to Pasuk Tet. B'nafshenu navi lachmenu, we had to trade our very lives for our food. Mipnei cherev hamidbar, against the sword of the desert. Now, there are strange things going on here. I thought there was no food, but all of a sudden they're able to buy food, but they have to sell away their very lives. This seems to go against what I'm saying. However, the key word to resolving this issue, as I was saying, that we were looking at stages of desolation in Jerusalem itself, where the starvation got so bad, that was it. And all of a sudden in verse chapter 5, all of a sudden there's food, even though they have to trade away everything for it. The trick is the word Hamidbar, Cherev Hamidbar, and I'll explain why that solves the issue, and really this is a further stage chronologically in the structure of the Jewish people. Finally, in Pasuk, the Pasuk that reads, Oreinu Katanur Nichmaru, our skin has turned black like the ovens, Mipnei Zalafot Ra'av, from the Zalafot, we can look at the Mefarshim, the various translations, but it probably means the starvation, the pain, the agony of desolation. So something's weird of famine. Something's weird is going on here. They're still starving, and yet somehow there seems to be food in the desert to be achieved. So we'll take a look at that. But first, we'll go back to chapter 1, and we'll look at the next phase, which is Jerusalem herself. And I'm going to switch into desktop mode just to show you quickly what I am, how I'm breaking down the next piece. And what we have here is Jerusalem, which also goes through five phases, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 4, and chapter 5, four phases, which describe four separate identifiable phases of what happens to Jerusalem herself. And I'll switch back into video mode. I'll see if I get my video back, just a second, bear with me. Okay, there I am. Let's take a look at chapter 1, and here I have to say I'm going against Rashi and other Mefarshim, but I think it's a close read of the text. I think it's an accurate read of the text. The general assumption is, as soon as we start Echa Yashiva Vadad, Ayir Abatiyam, Hayita Ki Almana Rabati, Vagoyim Sarati, Bamdinod, Hayita Lama. So the sense is that the structure has already happened. The temple has fallen, Jerusalem has fell. But what I want to show to you is a close look at the text shows that that's not what's being described. Echaya Shvaba Dad in chapter 1, verse 1, says Jerusalem is still there, but she's lonely. Ha'ir Rabatiyam, she used to have tons of people. Haytak Almana, Rabati Vagoyim, she was the leader of all the cities. Sarati Bamtinot, Haytalama, she was given over to taxes. Usually taxes in the sense of not only money, but people as well. And what we're looking at here is what I described when I was being historical at the very beginning. Jerusalem was conquered, quote-unquote, by Nebuchadnezzar when he set up when he took Jehoiachin, the son of Yoshiahu, into exile, along with, as we saw, 2,000 people. That was the largest exile. It was emptied out of most of the powerful people because and Tzidkiyahu, whose name was Mataniahu at the time, was established as a puppet, or I don't know, maybe a puppet's too negative a sense, but certainly as a king or a leader that would play along with Nebuchadnezzar's game. That's the phase that we're talking about here in chapter 1. Chapter 1 does not describe a Jerusalem destroyed. It describes a Jerusalem that has gone from an independent city of an independent country to a city with very few people, because we remember those 2,000 people that were exiled in the seventh year of Nebuchadnezzar when he established Hezekiah as a king. Now take a look at Pasuk Dalet. Darchei Etzion Avelot, Nibli Ba'ei Mo'ed, Kol Sharea Shomimim. That is, Kol Sharea, the pathways of Zion are abandoned. Mibli Ba'ei Mo'ed, nobody comes for the Moadim anymore. Now that means that while they're abandoned, they're still there. Kol Sharea Shomimim, their gates are desolate. That doesn't mean that they are knocked down. That means that nobody's coming in and out of Jerusalem. A good example of this might be the way the old city was, the Temple Mount, and then Har Zeitim during the time when Jordan had that part of East Jerusalem and that part of the West Bank, where people simply couldn't come into their own territory. It's not exactly the same, because there was some Jewish control, but obviously things were so bad. The Kazdim were, the Chaldeans were walking the streets, there was pain and suffering, there was very little food. There was a nation on its way to being subjugated. So we have Kohanim. Kohanim ne'enachim, betulot nugot ve'imarla. There are the young girls who are, you know, should be standing in the street, but instead they're sighing. There are Kohanim that have no job because nobody's coming to bring. So the city exists in chapter 1, but it's in a state of despair. Let's take a look at Pasuk Hay. Hayu tzarel l'rosh oyveh shalu. Her enemies became the leaders. Oyveh shalu, from the word shalva, they became happy. Her enemies became happy. Ki Adonai hoga al rov shaha. Because God, hoga is the hifil of the word yagon, he caused pain because of all of its sins. Olaleha hachushvi lifnei tzar. Its children went out into exile. Now again, we tend to look at Tanakh as like, oh, there was one exile. When the temple fell, everybody went to exile as if there was like one train. But as I demonstrated with that first 15 minutes of a historical perspective, there were a series of exiles. Things are not black and white in Tanakh. They happen over a period of time. That exile that we're talking about, and again, I am disagreeing with Rashi here, there's no doubt about it, but I think that that's the way the Pasuk reads. This is not that everybody is exiled. This is the first exile in the time that Jehoiachin was exiled and put into jail, and Tzidkiah was put into power. And then finally, in Pasuk, the Pei Pasuk, which is verse, just a second, let me find out what verse it is. The Pei Pasuk, if my math was better, I could do it faster. The Pei Pasuk is verse 17, Yud Zayin. Persat Tzion Biadeh, that is, Zion exists. Now here we're personifying Zion as a woman. She exists, but she's stretching out her hands, Ein Menachem La, but nobody's there to comfort her. Tziva Adonai Le'akot, Tziva Tzarav, and their enemies all around. Haitai Yushalayim L'nidah Be'nehem. Yushalayim exists. And then finally, Michut Shikla Cherev Babayit Kamavet. That is, nobody's walking in the street because it's too dangerous. There's death all around. But you can still hide out in your house as you close the windows and blow out the candles and hope that nobody sees you in your house because of the pain and suffering of the very vicious Babylonian control over the city. Let's move on to chapter 2. And I'm going to have to go a bit faster, but in chapter 2, it really takes the first, just look at the first 5 or 6 psukim. And what's described here, now in chapter 1 I said that the city was standing, but the people were scared, food is running out, people are starting to realize, people are hiding in their houses of fear. In chapter 2, the destruction actually begins. And that's sort of the siege of Jerusalem that took place before the conquest. That was the Shivasar B'Tammuz, if you will. And what he does, what Yirmiyahu does in chapter 2, is he goes through a series of things that are starting to be destroyed. The Ne'ot Yaakov in verse 2, in Pasuk Bet, the Mivtzarei Ba'Yudah, the towers of Jerusalem start to get knocked down. In Pasuk Gimel, the Keren Yisrael, some kind of corner towers are thrown down. Vayivar Ba'Yaakov Ke'esh La'avan, the fires start to burn. In verse 5, Bilat Kol Armanotah, finally the Armanot, the watchtowers or the palaces or the governmental buildings start to come down. Shichet Mitzarav, the fortifications start to come down. And then finally in Pasuk Vav, it describes Vayachamos Kagan Suko. Even the temple starts to fall apart. So what you're taking a look at here is a process where, finally, in Pasuk Chet is probably a good place to finish up, and that's where this little piece of poetry from Aleph to Chet describing a step-by-step conquest of the Babylonian forces. Chashav Adonai Lashchit. Chashav doesn't mean he planned to, that means he actually did it. Chashav Adonai Lashchit, Chomat Batzion, the walls of Jerusalem, Natakav, which is a quote from Yeshayahu, where, you know, the plumb line is set to conquer, to knock down all the buildings. Lo Yeshiv Yadom Yibalea was all swallowed up, his hand was not withheld, God's hand. Vayavel Chel V'chomah, the inner walls and the outer walls all came tumbling down. And the next pasuk, Shibar Bricheha, her gates, and it's all coming down. So we're really looking at a different stage of Jerusalem, where Jerusalem still, in the first chapter, Jerusalem exists, but there was a human desolation. In the second chapter, there's an actual conquest process, where piece by piece, things start to fall apart, and that's where the food runs out. And now, if we take a look in chapter 4, if you take a look at verse Yud Aleph. Kila Adonai et Chamato. God completed with his anger. Shafach Charon Apo. He poured out all of the anger of his nose. Vayatzet Eish B'tzion Vatochal Yisodoteha. And this is a stage which is beyond that which we saw in chapter 2. Vatochal Yisodoteha. The very foundations of Jerusalem are completely destroyed, to the point where Lo Haaminu Malchei Aretz. At this point, we've got to the point where the enemy is completely in the city. Lo Haaminu Malchei Aretz, in verse 12, Malchei Aretz, Kol Yoshvei Tevel, Ki Yavot Tsar Voyeh B'Sharei Yushalayim. And now the enemy is, in chapter 2, there was a fight going on. They were fighting for the Armanot, they were fighting for the Mitzarim, they were fighting for the Heichal, they were fighting for all these places. One by one they fell, and what people can't believe in verse 12 here in chapter 4, is this is really post the destruction of the Jerusalem, the temple, and the city itself. And now the enemy comes and goes as it wishes, and people from the outside, the other nations, look inside and they simply can't believe what they saw, because here we're talking about the very end of the destruction. And here, the incredibly important verse, which will help us resolve the issue on chapter 5, which is, if you mention, I mentioned chapter 5, how come they have food back in chapter 5 if the food is all up in chapter 4? One possibility, of course, is that my theory of a chronology from chapter 1, 2, 4, and 5 is wrong. The other possibility is my theory is right, and what happens, importantly, is here in Pasuk Yud Tet of chapter 4, verse 19. Kalim hayu rodefenu minishrei shamayim. That is, once the city was destroyed, you don't have Jerusalemites anymore. You have either people that were taken captive or people who are running away to the desert, places like Matsada and other fortifications to survive. Kalim hayu rodefenu minishrei shamayim. So we tried running away from Jerusalem. But they were the people who chased us were faster than the either the eagles, according probably the vultures of the sky. Al heharim delakunu, they caught up with us even on the mountains. Bamidbar arvulanu, and they set up an orev is where you set up a whole bunch of people around to capture somebody when they go by a secret orev. Does anybody know the English word? It's called an ambush. And then Ruach Apeinu Mashiach Adonai Nilkav B'Shkiltotam, and then the Mashiach, who is the king, and we'll have to see who that is captured themselves. So what you're looking at here at the end of chapter 4 is Jerusalem is completely destroyed. The enemy is completely taken over the country, and the Yesodot of Jerusalem themselves, there's nothing left. So what happens? The people who aren't captured or killed run out into the desert, as they often do, the famous Judean desert. But what he's lamenting is even those people are captured. That is, they're in such bad straits that they try to run for the hills and they simply can't make it. And with that information, we can now look at chapter 5 and know exactly what's going on. Take a look at the pasuk that starts with Nachalatenu. Let me see if I can find out what pasuk it is. Just a second. Pasuk Bet. Nachalatenu Nefchal Zarim. Our property, that is the Judean hills, our cities, our fields, our farms, have been captured by the enemy. This is, by the way, a quote from Yeshayahu Perek Aleph. Batenu l'nachrim, the places where we live, they're now owned by the enemy. And why is it all captured? Because it says, Mipnei Cherev Hamidbar. So if you remember, they were looking for food. They were giving up their lives for food. Mipnei Cherev Hamidbar. That's Pasuk Tet. V'nafshenu Navi Lachmenu Mipnei Cherev Hamidbar. Which means that just going out into, we're exiled. Chapter 5, they're exiled and they're now in the runaway stage. They're hiding in the nooks and crannies of Jerusalem trying to put anything together. And there is some food out there. There are some farmers there. But it costs them, each man for himself, and trying to get food means they really have to not only sell huge amounts of money, but kesef mayim shatinu, even drinking a little bit of water in the desert, costs a huge amount of money. Now, who's charging them the money? Not the Bavel, because Bavel would kill them on the spot or exile them. But other people in the desert, the Jews themselves, the other survivors, whoever's got water, is making people pay a high price for that water, to the point in Pasuk Tet where it says, "Benafshenu lavi nachmenu," which can mean that they have to give away themselves in servitude to have a simple food, "Mipnei cherev hamidbar," because to go out into the desert to forage for yourself is sure death. And the sense of exile is in Pasuk Yudgimel, "Bacharim tchonasau," they have to carry these crushing stones, that is, unarim ba'itz kashalu, that is, the young men, the young soldiers are being taken away with wooden yokes on their shoulders. They're being carried out of Jerusalem. Some people run away, very few survive. Some of them manage to hide and squeeze a little bit of, pay every piece of money that they have or sell their souls for a little bit of food. And other people, what's being described here is oilanu kichatanu, Nafla Atar Roshenu, we're simply lost. Let's do one more piece. I'm going to stop here and just recap. So what we're seeing is in chapter 1, Jerusalem exists, but Zedekiah is set up as a king, but things are so bad in Jerusalem, people are hiding in their houses and the food is hard to come by. In chapter 2, Jerusalem actually, when Zedekiah rebels against his master in Nebuchadnezzar lays siege and starts to crack Jerusalem piece by piece. That's chapter 2. In chapter 4, the very Yesodot of Jerusalem are taken out, the temple is destroyed, there's nothing left. And in chapter 5, we have this human, what's left of humanity runs from, either they die in the city, they're taken into captive and put out and sell the, taken to captivity with the yokes on their shoulders, and for the few that manage to survive in the desert, it is a mean and terrible existence. Are there any questions before we go to the very last phase? We have 4 minutes, so we'll be able to do one more phase called leadership, and I'll be able to show you that leadership also changes chronologically from chapter 1, 2, and then 4 and 5. But are there any questions that people have before then? Okay, I'll go on. And the last piece, I'm not going to switch into a different mode. Just a second. Oh, I'm sorry. Yisrael is asking a question. Was this all written at one time? And I want to say, written, no. Edited, yes. Yirmiyahu survives the exile. And in fact, there's something of a recurrence until Gedaliah is killed. I think that probably, and I'm just guessing here, we don't know for sure, we have some text which indicates that scrolls are written piece by piece and then put together at the end. I think Yirmiyahu is probably writing a little bit as he goes on. And then after the final exile is when he gets 2 seconds to sit down and put together the incredible piece of poetry that we have in front of us with all the alphabetics and the reverse alphabetics and everything. So I think it was written in stages as Yirmiyahu saw it. And then he probably went back to finalize his book. And there is such a thing in Chazal where Yirmiyahu writes a scroll and he gives it to Baruch Ben Neriah to give it to Yehoyakim. Yehoyakim throws it into the fire and then Yirmiyahu has to write it again and write more. So there is this sense of a two-stage development. First writing during these chronological phases that I'm describing, and then a final editing or perhaps redaction might be better by Yirmiyahu himself, by the way. I'm not going with any multiple authorship here. It tastes like Yirmiyahu all the way through. But this is where he gets a chance to sort of sit down. I don't want to say relax, because he's not relaxed, but at least be able to put together his thoughts in a cogent and incredibly poetic way. So the answer to your question is, written at one time, no, but finally written and redacted, that would be, I think, at one time. Was it done with Nebuah? Excellent question, Yisrael. When it comes to Sefer Ketuvim, and of course the Megillot are Ketuvim, it's hard to some people, like the Vilna Gaon, not the Vilna Gaon, I'm sorry, Rav Sadia Gaon, much earlier than Vilna Gaon, said that every piece of Kedumim has the same piece of, it's all at the same level of Nevuah. That is, there's no difference the level of Nevuah between a Megillah and between Sefer Yehoshua, for instance. That is, all Nachas is the same. And Rav Chaim Halevi, Soloveitchik, proves it halachically by saying that you could put a Torah on top of a Navi and Ketuvim. You can't put a Navi or Ketuvim on top of a Torah, but you can put a Navi on top of a Ketuvim, and you could put a Ketuvim on top of a Navi. So according to Rav Chaim, that proved that they were equal in Nevuah. However, I would have to say that the Rambam disagrees, and I lean a little bit like the Rambam. And his Mor Nevuchim describes 48 stages of Nevuah. Ketuvim are written sort of at the third level, something called Ruach HaKodesh, which is, you know, inspiration. So the Navi is aware of what he's doing, as opposed to Nevuah, where he's like in a transcendental state. So I would like to say it's somewhere in between inspired and prophetic. What it could be, by the way, is part of this writing and redaction. It could be that he had this nevuah during the writing phases, and then he was able to express himself using his own inspiration, which might be a step. It's still nevuah, but it's a step below. Okay. It's 10 o'clock. What I would do is I'll give you homework. I'll end with this. What I would suggest is go to the issue of leadership. Look for Kohanim, Nevi'im, Sarim, and Melachim. And you'll notice that in chapter 1, 2, 4, and 5, that there are stages. That first they're just sighing, and then they're brought low, and then people are make fun of them, and then they're completely trapped and destroyed. And what you'll see is these also fit into the four phases of chronological Eicha. And just to repeat that, where would you find it? I have a question, where would you find it? These things, just look for the words Melech, and Sar, and Navi, and Kohen in chapters 1, 2, 4, and 5. Look at what's happening to these characters, and you'll see that there's a chronological process which is getting worse and worse and worse. Again, the first stage, just to sum up, the first stage being the arrival of Nebuchadnezzar, the massive exile, but Tzidkiyahu is still the king for 11 years. The second chapter being the siege of Jerusalem. The fourth chapter being after the complete destruction of Jerusalem. And the fifth chapter being the torn away people, the nationless people who at best are wandering with nothing in the desert, managing to flee spies and enemies, and at the very worst are killed or brought into Babylonian exile. And I think that if you look at leadership, you'll find there's this four-step process. The leader himself speaks, and I think that is chapter 3. Some people think it's Yirmiyahu, some people think it's Tzidkiyahu. I think it's Yehoyachin, who was exiled during the first exile, and that's up to you to decide. That's up to you to decide. Anyway, have a very good night, and it's been a pleasure teaching Eicha. Hopefully we'll never see anything like this, and hopefully, like Santayana said, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. So hopefully the pain and suffering that we have by reading Eicha will keep it forever happening again. Have a good night.